a horrible black labyrinth, reeking from end to end with the vilest exhalations. Its streets, mere kennels of horrent putrefaction. Its every wall, its every object, slimy with the indigenous ooze of the place, swarming with human vermin, whose trade is robbery and whose recreation is murder. The catacombs of London, darker, more tortuous, and more dangerous than those of Rome, and supersaturated with foul life.
You are now entering London's East End to experience the Autumn of Terror. Please note that this episode contains adult themes and descriptions of violent crimes, which may not be suitable for all audiences. The use of the term prostitution is in no way intended to cause offence, but it will be used in this series for historical accuracy, as that is what it was referred to back then. Primary sources have been used as much as possible. This series has been created with the utmost respect for the victims in mind.
Hello and welcome back to the dark, foggy streets of Victorian London for the second part of this Jack the Ripper mini-series. If you haven't already, please go back and listen to the first episode where we discovered the vicious murders of Emma Smith and Martha Tabram. Although they were killed not long before the five canonical victims, many researchers don't believe they died at the hands of the Ripper. So let's jump in a hansom cab and make our way to the scene where the first of the confirmed Jack the Ripper victims was found. Here we are in Bucks Row, although today it's known as Durwood Street, and it runs parallel to Whitechapel Road. If you look around, you'll notice it's extremely dark. There was only one street lamp at the end of the road. The shadows make it feel even more threatening and oppressive. It was just 24 feet across at its widest end, although this was not the narrowest street in the area by far. The road was lined with warehouses, factories and terraced cottages, as well as a five-storey high board school, which educated children between 5 and 12, and had a distinctive rooftop playground. In 2020, this building still exists, but has been turned into apartments. What we're looking at is Brown's stable yard, which sat between the board school and a row of cottages. It's about 3:40 a.m. on Friday, 31st of August, 1888. It was in front of the dark gateway belonging to Brown's stable yard that an unwitting man on his way to work first stumbled upon the terrible sight of a body. If we listen quietly, we'll hear what happened as the scene played out. This is dramatised, but based on witness testimony from the time.
What's this? Oh my God, it's a person! Come and have a look over here. There's a woman lying on the pavement.
Let's have a look. Her hands and face are cold.
I believe she's dead.
I think she's still breathing, but very little if she is. Come on, help me lift her.
I don't think we should. Let's find a bobby.
A bobby was a slang word for a policeman in those days, as it was the nickname of Sir Robert Peel, who set up the first official police force in England in 1829. Consequently, they were also sometimes known as peelers. The Metropolitan Police was split into 20 divisions covering different areas of the city. Constable Mizen of H Division was on his beat in Hanbury Street, a road name you'll need to remember for later, as it would soon become the scene of another murder. A beat was the term for the territory that a police officer patrolled, and each officer had his own beat, which would normally take between 15 and 30 minutes to walk. They would continue walking this route for the duration of their shift, checking that everything was normal, acting on anything suspicious, and generally making their presence known, both for reassurance and deterrence, depending on whether you're an innocent citizen or a criminal. At some point, the officers on duty would meet up at a fixed point called a joining beat. Another part of Constable Mizen's role was as a knocker-upper. Despite the strange name, this was quite simple and just involved him knocking on people's doors to wake them up for work, a bit like a primitive alarm clock. Many people in those days had to get up as early as 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'll be talking a bit more later in this episode about the kinds of jobs people in Whitechapel had.
Time to wake up. Get up for work, time to wake up.
Constable, there's a woman lying in Bucks Row on her back. She must be either dead or drunk.
All right, show me.
Constable Mizen hurried to the scene, but by then, Constable Neil of J Division had already stumbled across the body on his beat. With the aid of his lamp, he saw the woman's eyes were wide open and blood was oozing from her throat. Her bonnet was lying next to her side, close to her left hand. Neil called out for his colleague, PC Thane, who was nearby, telling him,
"Here's a woman has her throat cut. Run at once for Dr. Llewellyn."
Dr. Llewellyn, who lived just 300 yards away, came immediately and pronounced that life was extinct and gave the order for the body to be moved to the dead shed, the Whitechapel mortuary. Although it wasn't his legal right to do this, and he should have waited until a police inspector had arrived. After the body was removed from the scene, a bucket of water was thrown over the street to wash away the blood. As it was still quite dark, the full nature of the crime didn't become apparent until after the body arrived at the dead shed, which also explains why the two men who first found it didn't notice the extent of the woman's wounds. Also, she was lying on her side when she was found. One of the men would later testify that he thought at first that the body was a tarpaulin left in the road. On examining the corpse, Inspector Spratling noticed that the victim had been horribly mutilated, the intestines hanging out of a deep abdominal wound, and he called the Welsh doctor back to conduct a full post-mortem. Here's how one newspaper reported the murder.
"The affair is enveloped in complete mystery, and the police have as yet no evidence to trace the perpetrators of the horrible deed. As Constable John Neal was walking down Bucks Row, Whitechapel, about 3:45 this morning, he discovered a woman between 35 and 40 years of age, lying at the side of the street with her throat cut right open from ear to ear. The wound was about 2 inches wide and blood was flowing profusely. She was conveyed to the Whitechapel mortuary, where it was found that, besides the wound in her throat, the lower part of her person was completely ripped open. The wound extends nearly to her breast and must have been affected with a large knife. As the corpse of the woman lies in the mortuary, it presents a ghastly sight. The hands are bruised and bear evidence of a severe struggle. Some of the front teeth have been knocked out, and the face is bruised on both cheeks and very much discoloured."
Dr. Llewellyn's post-mortem report gave a little more detail. Now, I just need to go into the coroner's office to get the paperwork for you, so I hope you don't mind waiting here for a moment. Please feel free to take in the sights and sounds around you, and I won't be long.
"A pleasure to see you, Mr. Rumler.
Good morning. How are you faring, Mr. Beck? Have you spoken to Mr. Hutchinson or Mr. Evans lately?"
"No, I haven't. But I have been in the company of Mr. Blommer. He's a fascinating gentleman."
"Get your chestnuts. Warm the cockles on a cold day. Get your hot chestnuts. Any hot chestnuts, sir?"
Right, sorry about that. I've spoken to the coroner and got hold of Dr. Llewellyn's statement for you. Here it is.
"The body was that of a female of 40 or 45. Five of the teeth were missing, and there was a slight laceration of the tongue. There was a bruise on the lower part of the jaw, on the right side of the face, which might have been caused by a fist or pressure from a thumb. There was a circular bruise on the left side of the face, which also might have been inflicted by the pressure of the fingers. On the left side of the neck, 1 inch below the jaw, was an incision about 4 inches in length, running from a point immediately below the ear. An inch below was a circular incision, terminating at a point 3 inches below the right jaw and completely severing all the tissues down to the vertebrae. The large vessels of the neck on both sides were severed. The incision was about 8 inches in length. The cuts must have been caused by a long-bladed knife used with great violence. On the left side of the lower abdomen was a very deep, jagged wound. There were several incisions running across the abdomen, with 3 or 4 similar cuts running downwards on the right side, all caused by a knife. The injuries were from left to right and might have been done by a left-handed person. All were caused by the same instrument.
Later, Dr. Llewellyn's assertion that the killer might have been left-handed would be questioned. Interestingly, Llewellyn's description didn't mention that the victim's intestines were hanging out of the abdominal wound, probably because this wasn't the full autopsy report, as those records haven't survived, and we only have newspaper reports from the inquest to refer to. It has also been put forward that the intestines weren't originally hanging out, but that rough handling of the body and the bumpy journey on the cart from the crime scene to the mortuary might have caused them to erupt from the deep wound. So who was the victim, and what were her movements in her final hours on Earth? Mary Ann Walker, often known as Polly, was born in 1845 in Shoe Lane in the City of London and had celebrated her 43rd birthday just 5 days before her death. She was 5'2", with brown eyes, brown hair turning grey, several missing teeth, high cheekbones and grey eyes. A friend from her lodging house, Emily Holland, described Polly as a very clean woman who always seemed to keep to herself. Polly married a printer's machinist called William Nichols in 1864 and led a respectable life with him, becoming some of the first tenants of social housing owned by Peabody, a housing association which still exists today. Polly worked at a printer's shop and earned 30 shillings a week, and the couple had 3 sons and 2 daughters. Her marriage fell apart when she discovered that her husband was having an affair, and by 1881 they had split for good, and Polly turned to prostitution, moving from lodging house to lodging house, and even sometimes the workhouse, occasionally resorting to sleeping rough in Trafalgar Square. Workhouses were the last resort for people living in poverty, and many would rather have died than go there. If you were unfortunate enough to end up in one, any clothing and possessions you still owned would be taken away from you, men and women would be separated, and you would be forced to take a bath in a tub of water, which might have been used by up to 20 people before you. You would be given a uniform and shown to your bed, which was a hammock just a few inches above the ground. You would be woken at 5 a.m. for a meagre breakfast, ready to spend the whole day working, which would be scrubbing, cleaning, breaking stones, chopping wood, or many other back-breaking tasks. Women might also have been given needlework or oakum picking, which was unravelling the fibres from old ropes, which were then sold to shipbuilders for mixing with tar to seal the lining of wooden boats. This was much harder work than it sounds, and long days of doing this would make the fingers bleed and even cause tendinitis and nerve damage. But there was no choice, and they had to labour for long hours to earn a bed and food, although that was terrible too. Things like pea soup, barley soup, rice pudding, or if they were very lucky, meat and potato pie. Workhouses were an all too familiar part of life for people living in poverty. Silent film actor Charlie Chaplin spent time in a workhouse when he was just 7 years old, and American author Jack London visited England in 1902 and spent time in workhouses and doss houses just so he could experience what life was like for those inside them. Fortunately for Polly Nichols, when she went to Lambeth Workhouse on 16th of April 1888, she didn't stay there long. It was common for workhouses to find jobs for the female inmates, they found her a position as a domestic servant for a wealthy couple. A letter exists that she wrote to her father about her new role.
I'd just write to say you'll be glad to know that I'm settled in my new place and going all right up till now. My people went out yesterday and have not returned, so I'm left in charge. It is a grand place inside, with trees and gardens back and front. All has been newly done up. They are teetotalers and religious, so I ought to get on. They are very nice people, and I have not much to do. I hope you're all right and the boy has work. So, goodbye for the present. From yours truly, Polly. Answer soon, please, and let me know how you are.
By the boy, she probably meant her eldest son Edward, who was living with Polly's father. The other four children had stayed with her ex-husband, William Nichols. The last time she'd seen her father had been 2 years before in June 1886, at her brother's funeral. He was also called Edward and had died after setting his hair alight with a paraffin lamp by accident. This letter about her new job was the last time she ever had contact with her father. Sadly, despite having a taste of a better life, Polly ran away from her role as a domestic servant in July 1888, stealing clothes and money from her employers and ending up back in a lodging house once again. On the night of Thursday, 30th of August 1888, Polly tried to get a bed at 18 Thrall Street, Spitalfields, but was turned away because she didn't have enough money. She said,
"I'll soon have my dust money. See what a jolly bonnet I have."
She was referring to how easy she anticipated it would be to earn her fourpence to pay for a bed for the night, as she felt her appearance, improved by her new hat, would attract plenty of clients. Just after midnight, on Friday 31st of August, she was seen leaving the Frying Pan public house at the corner of Brick Lane and Thrall Street. At 2:30 a.m, she bumped into Emily Holland, a friend and fellow lodger, on the corner of Osborne Street and Whitechapel Road, which happened to be where Emma Smith had been attacked several months before. Back then, this was near a grocer's shop, which today is a fish and chip shop named, with a macabre yet jaunty humour, Jack the Chipper. Other businesses have cashed in on the Whitechapel murders connection, so you'll also find a hairdresser nearby called Jack the Clipper. Perhaps somewhere you can also buy footwear from Jack the Slipper, or fresh fish from Jack the Kipper.
Hello, Emily.
Hello, Polly. Why don't you come back to the lodging house with me?
Nah, I still need to get me dust money. I've had it 3 times over today and spent it on drink.
Oh, Polly, what are you like?
Don't worry, it won't be long before I'm back.
The two women spoke for a few more minutes before they separated. Emily to return to the lodging house, Polly clearly drunk, to find another client to earn her DOS money for the night. She staggered east down Whitechapel Road, and this was the last time she was seen alive. Just over an hour later, she was found dead in Buck's Row. The autumn of terror had just begun. At this time, there were no suspects, and the name Jack the Ripper had yet to be brought to life. So police didn't know they were dealing with a serial killer. But even if they had, they wouldn't have used that phrase, as the term wasn't used until decades later. In recent years, it has been suggested that the man who found Polly Nichols' body could have been the murderer. So who were the two men who were first on the scene? The first man gave his name as Charles Cross, although he was later identified as Charles Letchmere. His stepfather was a police constable called Thomas Cross, so it's possible that he felt giving that name would give him more credence, or maybe he just didn't want to be identified, as witnesses' names were always printed in the papers. I'll refer to him as Cross for ease. The second man, who arrived just moments later, and to whom Charles spoke and pointed out the body, was Robert Paul. Both Cross and Paul were carmen, on their way to work. A carman was someone who transported goods in a horse and cart. It might seem unusual to us today that they were on their way to work so early in the morning, but back then, many jobs started well before dawn. Many people in Whitechapel were dock labourers, butchers, market traders, fish porters at Billingsgate Fish Market, or sold anything they could on the street. There are many trade names unfamiliar to us today. For example, a costermonger was someone who sold fruit and vegetables from a handcart, a chandler was a candle maker, and a cooper was someone who made barrels. The overcrowding in the East End meant that the number of people far outweighed the available jobs, and for many, it was a hand-to-mouth existence. Polly Nichols was certainly not alone in struggling to pay for a bed for the night, and it wasn't uncommon for people to survive day to day, earning just enough to cover their lodgings that night, but with little left over for food. It's not surprising that excessive drinking was widespread, as whenever there was a little extra money to be had, it was spent on drowning the sorrows of being trapped in an unhygienic, crowded, poverty-stricken life.
God blimey! Just wait till I tell me old mum.
Get your chestnuts. Warm the cockles on a cold day.
Read all about it.
Get your hot chestnuts.
Read all about it. Nasty murder.
Any hot chestnuts, sir?
Cross and Paul neither saw nor heard anyone leaving the scene of the murder. Cross lived in nearby Doveton Street, just half a mile away from Bucks Row, and it would have taken less than 10 minutes for him to arrive at the scene after leaving his home. He worked for a company called Pickford's, which still exists today. There's no real evidence to suggest that Cross was the killer, but in the absence of any other information, it makes sense to consider the first person on the scene. After all, Robert Paul arrived very shortly afterwards, having been about 40 yards behind Cross, and also travelling in the same westerly direction towards Bucks Row. And it could be argued that Cross was in the middle of the mutilation when he heard someone approach. Rather than running and making himself look suspicious, he could have pretended to have stumbled across the body. The fight or flight response kicked in and he chose to stand his ground, or at least that's what some claim. In some documentaries, Cross is shown leaning over the dead woman, an image which has helped give rise to suspicion. But this wasn't actually the case, and Robert Paul testified that when he came upon the scene, Cross was standing in the middle of the road. There was a misunderstanding in the reports about the wording used when Cross and Paul approached a policeman, as Constable Mizen claimed the two men said, "You're wanted in Bucks Row by a policeman," or words to that effect. However, Cross and Paul both denied this at the inquest. People who suspect Cross was the killer use this to their advantage, suggesting that by telling Mizen they'd been sent by another police officer at the scene, they were giving the impression that the other, Bobby, would have taken their details already, thereby avoiding any suspicion falling on them from Mizen. It's probable that when Mizen arrived in Bucks Row and saw that Constable Neil had already found the body, the facts of the conversation simply got mixed up in his mind, and he assumed that Cross and Paul had mentioned that a policeman was already at the scene. I think it's unlikely that Charles Cross had anything to do with the murder of Polly Nichols, and surely somebody would have noticed he was covered in blood. Besides, killing someone on the way to work would be a bad idea for this very reason. A question that remained was, where did Polly go between 2:30 a.m. when she parted from Emily Holland and 3:30 a.m. when she was killed? It would only have taken 10 to 15 minutes to walk from the corner of Osborne Street and Whitechapel Road to Bucks Row. What happened to the remaining 45 minutes? The pubs were closed by 2 a.m, so it was assumed that she was walking around looking for customers. Whitechapel Road was busy even at that time of night, but although it's therefore possible that people did see her, they may not have had any particular reason to remember her. As for how the murderer struck, he could have pretended to be a client and lured her away to a quiet spot. Alternatively, it could have been a very sudden blitz attack with no prior communication at all. It was noticed that the stable gate to Brown's yard was locked, so it was possible that the perpetrator had originally planned to kill his victim in the yard, out of sight, but on finding it locked, decided to commit the murder in the street anyway, as he had gone too far to stop his brutal impulse. Or Polly could have been the one to lead him there, if she had previously taken clients to the yard. Either way, all the evidence proved she was killed there, rather than dying elsewhere and being dumped in Bucks Row. By the way, the reason we haven't heard about Inspector Edmund Reed, who'd investigated Martha Tabron's murder, was that he operated in H Division, while Bucks Row fell into J Division. Unfortunately, J Division's records are not as thorough as H. In any case, for some reason, no police reports survive from Polly Nichols' murder, so most of the information we have is put together from newspaper reports of the time. The Perkis family, who lived at Essex Wharf just opposite the murder scene, a three-story building used as offices, didn't see or hear anything that night, and neither did Emma Green and her family, who resided at New Cottage, right next to Brown's stable yard. She admitted that the street was often busy and noisy, but claimed no knowledge that prostitution was rife in the area, perhaps to preserve her own reputation and social status, and give the impression that she lived in a better part of Whitechapel. This contrasts with a report by Inspector Frederick Aberline, which stated that Bucks Row was known to be frequented by prostitutes and their clients. He was heavily involved in the investigations, and we'll hear more about him later in this series. It was Emma Green's son James who helped to wash the bloodstains away under the watchful eye of PC Thane, a scene that was played out in the 1988 Michael Caine TV movie Jack the Ripper. Some people, however, thought that every part of Whitechapel was full of iniquity. Here's an extract from a colourful article by writer Arthur G. Morrison in the Palace Journal, published in April 1889, where he satirised the view that the area was wholly dreadful and reminded readers that this was a sweeping generalisation.
A horrible black labyrinth, reeking from end to end with the vilest exhalations. Its streets, mere kennels of horrent putrefaction. Its every wall, its every object, slimy with the indigenous ooze of the place, swarming with human vermin, whose trade is robbery and whose recreation is murder. The catacombs of London, darker, more tortuous, and more dangerous than those of Rome, and supersaturated with foul life. Others imagine Whitechapel in a pitiful aspect. Outcast London. Black and nasty still, a wilderness of crazy dens into which pallid wastrels crawl to die, where several families lie in each fetid room, and fathers, mothers, and children watch each other starve, where bony, blear-eyed wretches, with everything beautiful, brave, and worthy crushed out of them, and nothing of the glory and nobleness and jollity of this world within the range of their crippled senses, rasp away their puny lives in the sty of the sweater. Such spots as these there certainly are in Whitechapel and in other places, but generalities are rarely true. And when applied to a district of London so large as that comprised under the name of Whitechapel, never.
But people were certainly right to describe the area as a labyrinth. There were a dozen escape routes the killer could have taken to escape from Bucks Row and melt into the darkness. Or if he lived nearby, he could simply have disappeared inside his house or cottage and nobody was any the wiser. The maze-like nature of the Whitechapel streets could certainly explain why nobody saw the murderer escaping. Even three horse slaughtermen, Tomkins, Britton and Mumford, who were employed in nearby Winthrop Street and were questioned after they finished their shift around 6 or 6:30 a.m. At the inquest, rigorously presided over by Coroner Wynne Baxter, night watchman Patrick Mulshaw, who was employed by the Whitechapel District Board of Works, said that on the night of the murder, he was at the back of the Working Lads Institute, also in Winthrop Street. He was on duty all night until just before 6 a.m, watching some sewage works, presumably as a sort of watchman to make sure nobody interfered with them. He admitted to having fallen asleep a few times during the night, but was adamant that he was awake between 3 and 4 o'clock, and said he didn't see anyone during that time, and didn't hear any screams or cries for help. The first he knew of the murder was when a passerby said,
"Watchman, old man, I believe somebody is murdered down the street."
And yes, those were the exact words that were quoted in the inquest. They had a strange turn of phrase back then. Either the killer had passed by unnoticed when Mulshaw was dozing on duty, or maybe he did hear something but didn't realise what it was and considered it to be unimportant. Another witness, Harriet Lilly, lived just 2 doors down from the spot where the body was found.
"I slept in the front of the house and could hear everything that occurred in the street. On that Thursday night, I was somehow very restless. Well, I heard something I mentioned to my husband in the morning. It was a painful moan, 2 or 3 faint gasps, and then it passed away. It was dark, but a luggage train went by as I heard the sounds. There was, too, a sound as of whispers underneath the window. I distinctly heard voices, but cannot say what was said. It was too faint. I then woke my husband and said to him, 'I don't know what possesses me, but I cannot sleep tonight.'"
It was established that a goods train did pass by at about 3:30 a.m, so it's likely that Harriet was telling the truth. But her statement was only printed in a few papers, and she wasn't called to the inquest. It's impossible to say the exact time the train passed, as the railway company were notorious for running an inaccurate timetable. But if it was around 3:30, then Carmen Charles Cross might have missed the murderer by only a few minutes. If he'd left his home a little earlier, he might have stumbled across the killer in action and got a look at his face. The timing is confirmed by PC Neil, who passed Bucks Row on his beat at about 3:15 a.m, but saw nothing. The killer was either very clever or incredibly lucky to have committed his crime sometime after the policeman passed by at 3:15, but before he came back again at 3:30, a narrow window of opportunity. The inquest jury returned a verdict of willful murder by person or persons unknown. It's often questioned why more people didn't see or hear anything. It could have been that they did, but had a mistrust of the police and chose not to come forward. Or even simpler still, they feared losing a day's pay if they were called to the inquest. In later murders, many more witnesses came forward, which could be because the hysteria was building as the crimes escalated in brutality, and people were more inclined to speak up when they realised the multiple murderer was at large. The first murder of a serial killer is a crucial one, as it defines his MO and helps him or her to identify any mistakes or weaknesses in their plan, which then may evolve as time goes on. Although the murder of Polly Nichols in Bucks Row was the first of the 5 canonical Ripper murders, it doesn't receive as much attention as the others, perhaps due to their lack of official police reports and the need to rely on newspapers. The nature of the sources we do have mean that there's a lot of speculation. There are many things we don't know for sure. For example, the exact routes the police beats took. Let's not forget that at this point, Police had no idea they were dealing with a serial murderer, and the name Jack the Ripper still hadn't been coined. But it wouldn't be long before he became a sinister household name.
Read all about it! Read all about it! Another terrible murder!
I'm sorry, did you say there's been another one?
Yes, down Ambry Street. Horrible. Do you want a paper, mister?
I think I better had. Thank you. I think that was our cue to move on to the next gruesome murder. I'd better read the newspaper I've just bought from that young man to find out what's happened in Hanbury Street, so I can tell you about it next time in the third episode of this mini-series. By now, the Autumn of Terror was well and truly underway, and Whitechapel would never be the same again. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please consider taking the time to leave me a review. It really does help to grow this podcast and spread the word. This was part two of a 7-part Jack the Ripper mini-series, which is being released over a period of just 14 days. Don't forget, if you can't wait for the next instalment, the entire mini-series is already available to my wonderful Patreon supporters. So if you'd like to get access to this and other benefits, as well as help to keep the show alive, I'll include a link in the notes below. Until next time, take care, everyone.